call us back to order again. And Jim, you gave us a bunch of handouts. Maybe if you want to go through those and kind of help us with those a little bit.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rob, is this a time we should remind the board that we have to have a reason for our vote, and or should we do that at more at the motion time?
Madam Chair.
Yeah, you can go ahead, but we might need to remind them again when it comes time for the motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Board members, it's always a good time to remind you that as part of the process of making of reaching a decision on this petition, the board has to have a number of things. The decision has to be in writing, it has to be based on record evidence, and then there have to be specific reasons for the decision, whether the board denies the petition or initiates rulemaking. And so as far as record evidence goes, Jim, could you explain some of the materials that were handed out? One more thing, and I'll just note to the board. I handed each board member got a copy of Wyoming's Rules and Regulations, Section 45, regarding pre-frac disclosure. Wayne, this was in response to your question. This document, the pre-frac disclosure, had already been sent to the board members, I think at least once, maybe twice, electronically and in paper form. But I wanted to thank Ms. O'Brien for providing another copy today so that everybody has it handy.
Okay, Madam Chair, members of the board, all of the staff has spent a significant amount of time reviewing the petition and the papers that were submitted, the technical papers that were submitted along with the petition. This is a complex issue, and I thought before I started on these specific exhibits, I'd just mention a couple of things to put this into perspective a little bit. I went through an estimate. Really, we only have distinct indication of wells that have been hydraulically fractured in Montana in those cases where the hydraulic fracturing was performed subsequent to the completion of the well. Because prior to the adoption of our hydraulic fracturing rule in 2011, a hydraulic fracturing operation would be reported on the completion report. So it doesn't exist as an individual entry in our database. But for a little bit of perspective, we estimate that somewhere between 4,000 and 7,000 wells have been fracked in Montana to date, and that's based off of reservoir type primarily. Gas wells in the Bedoyan area, gas wells in the Cedar Creek Anticline usually require hydraulic fracturing. We have our Bakken wells that we know of. And the first recorded hydraulic fracture job that we could find in our database as an independent record was in 1951, and it was a well in Cutbank Field. And from those wells that we know had an actual record of hydraulic fracturing, there's been 132 fields that have had wells within their boundary hydraulically fractured, and that includes the two fields that the Bakken production comes from. So the other thing that we just kind of found is introductory. In 2015, it appears that 65% of the state's oil production and 39% of the gas production came from hydraulically fractured wells. So we've been dealing with hydraulic fracturing for a long time as staff, and it's good to take a point in time and sit back and actually understand where we are. So with those introductory comments, the staff, Rob in particular, all of us sat down and thought about what are the things that are pertinent to the application that is before the board today. And this was actually brought up in one of, I think it was the oral testimony from Alan Olson. One of the issues that we have in front of us right now is the fact that our fundamental hydraulic fracturing rule is in the hands of the Supreme Court now. Package 2, Exhibit 1 is just a copy of that filing that was made in October of 2015. And I didn't copy any of their motions or additional material, but I think it's clear from the first page this is a notice of constitutional challenge of our hydraulic fracturing rule. If the Supreme Court, and Rob can jump in on this, but Rob's trained me a little bit, that the Supreme Court could make a ruling that directly reflected on the adequacy of our rules or the constitutionality, or they could return the case to district court. And if it gets back to district court, then I foresee another period of time that we'll be in limbo to figure out exactly what the legal requirements may be for our hydraulic fracturing rule. So in our process of review, that was one of the things that we felt to be the most, one of the more significant issues. Exhibit 2 in Package 2. And this really has to deal with, the board's been grappling with the issue of how do we make certain that the people that are most likely, or that would most likely be the ones impacted by the drilling of a well. For years we've had a notice requirement in place, I think since the early 90s or late 1980s, that if you were to drill a well outside of the boundary of a delineated field, you would have to give notice to the newspaper in Helena and the newspaper of the county in general circulation. There's also a statutory requirement that the owner of the land upon which a well is drilled is given notice of the drilling operations. And that's independent of whether it appears in the newspapers or not because of the definition of wildcat well or delineated field. All landowners are covered by statute. Now, it is important for those people that are close to a well to have an opportunity to come before the board and understand what's going on when a well is drilled, and that resulted in the rule that was published in October of 2016 that we are expanding notification to include occupied structures. And that rule proposal was published with the Secretary of State in October 26, 2016. And that rule plays a significant part, I think, in the involvement of the people with water wells near a drilling well. It gives them the opportunity to come to a board hearing and, well, basically hold up the permit until the hearing is held to determine if stipulations are necessary. The stipulations could range from having to sample a water well by the company if the landowner wished to have his water well sampled, which is not always the case, or any other operational stipulation that could play a role. So I think that's a significant thing that we've got on the table right now until we know the outcome of that notice rule. It's hard to tell. The other thing that we learned during the creation of the notice rule is that very few wells in Montana in the last 6 years were drilled within a quarter of a mile of a home. So you could almost assume that very few wells were drilled within the quarter of a mile of a water well. So we are still a rural state, and unlike the area around Cheyenne or Colorado north of Denver, the majority of our activity occurs some distance away from homes. In those cases where a home was present, I believe only 0.3%, is that correct? Or was it 3%? That the home was owned by someone other than the landowner that received the notice.
There would be 2.3% affected by the new rule.
Right. So 97 plus percent of the people that could potentially have water wells were already notified because of the landowner notice requirement in statute. And as Ben said, adoption of a notice requirement, in effect, only impacts 2.3% of the wells that were drilled because it would have a homeowner who was different than the surface owner of the land that the well was drilled on. So that was the first time that we really got into the magnitude of where does our drilling occur with respect to homes and development. So that's another thing that's hanging in the air. I've included the full text of that notice for your reference, but the board voted on that at the last meeting, and we will have a public hearing and comment period. The public hearing will be held at our next board meeting, the October 26th, I believe, business meeting. Another thing that came to light during this discussion, Rob has already addressed, and he can be the one that will answer any questions about this, but there were changes to the federal, well, there's actually establishment of Federal Trade Secrets Act law that used to be deferred to the states, if my understanding is correct. And that happened in May of 2016. And we're really at the fundamental stages of understanding what impact that has, could have on us, and whether or not it impacts Wyoming's existing rule, I think, would be a question in my mind at this time. So if Rob has some additional information he'd like to add to that.
Rob.
Madam Chair, in general, trade secret laws has always been governed by state law. There has been criminal prosecution available under federal law, but it was only very recently, May this year, that the civil portions of trade secret law were federalized. How that impacts Montana, whether that impacts Montana or other states, and how it might impact Montana and other states is unclear to me. And I haven't seen a whole lot of information out there. It's too soon after the law was adopted to find a lot of reasoned, for example, law review articles discussing the impact of that federal law on the state trade secrets schemes. As it turns out, there may be nothing to it. It's unclear at this time what, if anything, that would be. And so I thought it was important to make the board aware that that's a significant change to trade secret law since the rules were adopted in 2011, but the exact impact of that change remains unknown.
Madam Chair, Rob pointed out to me that there's a possibility under that the board could not get in trouble for disclosing a trade secret, but I could. I have a personal interest in the interpretation of that.
It depends on the language and how the language is interpreted and applied, but it certainly does refer to civil actions regarding misappropriation by a person.
And exclude states in some cases, but... So I have an interest in that one. The next, Exhibit 5. Now, there are many issues that are mentioned in the papers that were submitted, the technical papers that were submitted along with the petition and the petition itself, that were discussed by the board at the time the current hydraulic fracturing rule was adopted. And I thought I'd just include that, and the board can look through the... They're toward the end, but there's comments and responses. And you'll notice discussions on things in there, including the need to have every chemical in order to determine that there's contamination, the time necessary to complete a well. But one of the most important things that I think came out of this, and it... Every so many years you have to rethink, but people drill a well to complete it. And a person would not drill an oil and gas well if he wasn't allowed to complete it. If we start to look at hydraulic fracturing as a separate action from the drilling of the well, we open the door to no one wanting to drill a well because they don't know for sure they're going to be able to complete it properly. And that was pointed out in one of the comments in here. There was a discussion on trade secrets, and at the time the board decided that even then who declares and who determines a trade secret was such a nest that we intentionally sidestepped it. That if someone wants to tell us that their thing is a trade secret, that's fine with us, because we know that there's law and rule that supports if there ever becomes an indication that there is contamination, those trade secret protections start to dissolve. So, and that was all addressed specifically in the responses as well. If you want to look through that, there may be some other things you can pick up, but those were the concerns that we came up with as we went through it. Exhibit number 6 really gets into an odd sort of a category, and with the beginning remarks that I made about, to us, hydraulic fracturing is not new. There's really another level of things that I think come into play in a true staff recommendation when we get to it later on. And the board is not tasked with preventing contamination of aquifers only for hydraulic fracturing. When you drill a well, there are fluids that are used. When you produce a well, there's fluids that are brought back to the surface. If there is an at-risk aquifer present at a well location, we best know that at the time we approve the drilling permit. Through the comments today and through some of the materials that were provided in the technical exhibits package, they talk about things like spills. Well, if a spill of hydraulic fracturing flowback fluid can enter an aquifer, so could salt water. Potentially, so could oil. Those are the things that we need to know at the time that the well is permitted. And I think it's very hard to separate comments about hydraulic fracturing from that actual well permit time. Because if it's at the time somebody decides to fracture a well 5 years after it's drilled, we may become aware of information that we should have known at the time we approved the drilling permit. So the history of this, the fact that we've had to consider it in our operations when we do well construction, when we do site approvals, whether we decide whether or not a pit has to be lined, is not just for the purpose of hydraulic fracturing. So I think we need to keep that in mind, that there's a whole world of things out there that we don't want in drinking water. And one of those is the material that might be associated with a hydraulic fracturing job. So on that basis, in the Exhibit 6, that's petition and exhibit analysis, Ben has contributed a lot to this. We've done an awful lot of discussion. George has looked through the technical papers that were submitted, and we've all read the petition. And I think it's one important point for the board to consider is there is no direct evidence that environmental damage or health and safety issues have resulted as because of our current rule. Now, there's the discovery thing, there are all of those things that something could be found, but at this point in time, and at any time since 1951, we have not heard of an issue where hydraulic fracturing has directly impacted groundwater. And at the time the rule was adopted, that was based on discussions with the DEQ and other state agencies that may hear those. One of the other things that we saw in the technical papers that I'll mention right now is that even though there was an allegation that something that showed up in a water well, and this would be the case in Pavilion, Wyoming, or in the case of the Pennsylvania wells, the chemical that showed up was not unique to the hydraulic fracturing process. It was also used in the, or could be available in the drilling process. So, saying that environmental damage is specific to hydraulic fracturing could become difficult. Second bullet is really gets into the exhibits that were submitted by the or along with the petition. And I think even some of the public comments that we got today, that this issue as presented in the documents, involve all phases of the well life, drilling, well construction, and production activities, in addition to fracture stimulation. Benzene was noted specifically today. Well, benzene appears or occurs in crude oil. A flaring was mentioned today. And when you look through the technical papers, a lot of their discussions get into air quality issues. All of that is really consistent with the board's historic and current position that all of the pertinent data and concerns must be gathered and addressed at the time the application for permit to drill is being evaluated. That's the only time that we can take action that can really prevent issues. And then I wanted to go through three of the papers that were very good papers, I thought, and they were the ones that really had a discovered chemical relationship that could be related to hydraulic fracturing. And one of those, it was the Beek et al. Paper. It's an easy one because it was the first one on the alphabet on the list that you were given. And it was an incident where there was casing failure in North Dakota that occurred during a hydraulic fracture job. And it was immediately known that there was an issue. Monitor wells were drilled around the well, and they were able to detect chemicals that had entered aquifers as a result of the casing failure. Luckily, this actually happened before we adopted our rule. This and one other event in North Dakota that had gained some notoriety were used when we created our rule. And there are specific steps in the hydraulic fracturing rule to make it nearly impossible for this to occur. The other thing that happens, we had rules in place, for example, that surface casing had to be at a depth that would protect all drinking water. So in the Williston Basin, a lot of times we'd have in excess of 2,000 feet of surface casing. So in order to keep that surface casing from rupturing during a hydraulic fracture job, should there be high pressure exposed to the wellbore, we require that the annulus be kept open. So that will keep that surface casing layer from being violated and something released into drinking water. So that one specifically really helped craft our current rule. There was a paper by DeGuglio and Jackson that was submitted in the package, and that dealt with Pavilion Field in Wyoming. And this is a very, very complex issue, but the Wyoming DEQ is now in charge of that project, trying to figure out what went on down there. They've released a preliminary report because it was found that the samples that the EPA took from their water test wells were determined by the United States Geological Survey to be improper. So the United States Geological Survey came in over the top of the EPA and said, no, your water samples that specifically showed contamination. In one case, they hadn't recovered all of the water all of the fluids that were associated with the drilling and cementing of the well due to low water volume. And in another case, the amount of water that was coming into the well was just inadequate to assume that it was flushed. They also had an issue that some of the same contaminants, which are fairly common in plastics, also occurred in the sample blanks in the lab. So the EPA decided to discontinue the study, and Wyoming DEQ was tasked with finishing it. DeGuglio and Jackson took the data from the EPA study and republished it in 2016. But on that basis, the Wyoming DEQ has gone in, collected their own samples, and used the samples from the EPA study, and they concluded that it was unlikely that the hydraulic fracturing fluids had risen into the aquifers. They identified that inadequate cementing of production or intermediate casing allowed the flow of gas and water from zones well above the production zone uphole into the aquifers. And they also said that that isn't something that's specific to a well that's been fracked or a new well or anything. Inadequate well construction at the time that the well was drilled was the cause of that. And that is certainly something that we're going to have to look for in the future when we have wells drilled in new areas. But, and then they also said that the use of unlined surface disposal pits contributed to aquifer contamination. So again, we have a study that potentially indicates a hydraulic fracturing contribution, but it opens the door to other issues that involve things that are determined at the time that the well is permitted. The third paper, Llewellyn in 2015, there was an awful lot of data. There have been areas in Pennsylvania definitely where there's been gas that's entered into aquifers. There have been chemicals detected in water wells. But Llewellyn followed up their paper because, as things sometimes happen now, their paper actually was turned into national headlines that went beyond what their conclusions were. So they did a clarification after their publication release, and I have just a couple of quotes out of there. The first one is, we explicitly state in the paper that there is no evidence that high-volume hydraulic fracturing of Marcellus shale at depths of 6,000 to 7,000 feet was the cause of the impacts. In fact, we provide strong evidence this did not happen. So the concept of something going on at depth, mechanically related to the hydraulic fracture, reaching the groundwater levels that are in use, to my knowledge, has not been established. So I have a tendency to look away from that. And then the second part of their clarification was, it's indeed likely that these impacts are derived from different sources. There is overwhelming evidence that natural gas migrated from two wells, and they had excessive annular pressures due to poor construction and subsequent remedial activities were successful in reducing sustained annular gas pressures. So there again is a case where it doesn't matter if the well was fracked or if the well was vertical or whatever. If you don't have adequate well construction when the well's drilled, you can have contamination. And then they had some specific chemicals that were found, and this again was a case where they couldn't be tied directly to the hydraulic fracturing. And I'll quote, first, the gas company was cited for a pit leak on the Wellis number one well pad, and this could therefore indicate a surface-related release. Second, drilling fluids could have leaked out of the gas well bores at shallow to intermediate depths. So that would be something that occurred at the time the well was being drilled and unrelated to the fracturing. The final scenario is leakage at shallow to intermediate depths of high-volume hydraulic fracturing fluids prior to or during injection at the Wellis 1 gas wells, well above the depth of hydraulic fracturing in the shale. It's not real clear to me what they're trying to indicate there, but that sounds to me like a casing failure, that some way you had fluids that went out. They're saying it's not communication from down deep, but somehow you had fluids that went out at a shallower level. So I keep myself going around in circles, that hydraulic fracturing is one thing, but there's this whole other world out there that really we're charged with protecting, and the only time you can protect from that is on the initial drilling permit. Now, the remaining technical papers document or introduce valid health-related concerns. And among some of those we heard of today are chemicals that can be used in the hydraulic fracturing process that have been known to cause specific birth defects or cancer or breathing issues potentially. But in none of the papers was there an instance where they had a direct causal relationship in that they'd found a chemical that came from hydraulic fracturing. The general consensus was that they're present and they could be used. So that's difficult. It recognizes that there is a concern, but at the technical level, there's no evidence there that can help us better construct a well or figure out how to do it, because we don't really know what went wrong. And in many of the papers, they talk about air emissions and, again, things that span the entire well life. Stress was indicated as one of them, as being something that could have showed up in the health records. Air quality was one, and they also posited that water contamination with hydraulic fracturing fluids could have done it, but again, it was not established. I think they were, the conclusions are valid, but the direct tie was not established. Similar to the Llewellyn paper, where they found contamination, but there were three possible scenarios that could have occurred, and there was overlap between chemicals used in hydraulic fracturing and chemicals that would be present in the drilling mud. So that really is the staff review of the petition and the accompanying documents. Madam Chair, I'm not sure Ben was the one that went through specifically and made notes on each one. I did that and I have them available here. If the board has any questions about those, we can do it probably in the discussion when we get done with the papers.
Sure, and I would like to ask Ben for his comments. Ben, would you like to make your comments?
Madam Chair, really, Jim did a pretty good job of summarizing my findings from the paper reviews as well. One additional finding I had, other than the three papers that Jim gave kind of the more in-depth description of, was the remaining papers did have potentially valid health concerns. However, the evidence in them didn't really support that the current rules in Montana were inadequate, or that if we did go ahead with the rulemaking petition, that would resolve the issues in those papers. So I found the three papers that Jim mentioned with the North Dakota blowout, the Pavilion, and the Llewellyn paper to be the most relevant ones to this as well. That's about all I had.
Thank you, Ben.
Yep, thank you.
Board members, did you have anything that you need to discuss or ask questions about?
Madam Chair, I do have the one to go through if we want to before we fall into general discussion. I think industry is the culprit for this one, but we're always beaten on to some extent about legislative intent and legislative solutions, and we all recognize that sometime in January there is going to be a legislative session, which would give the opportunity for the current petitioners to look for a legislative solution, us to look for a legislative solution, or for one to appear that none of us know about at this time. And in line with that, industry always tells us that we've got to follow legislative intent. I wanted to remind the board that in 2015 there was House Bill 243 that was introduced, and I've attached it just for your reference so you could compare to what was in it with what is in the current petition. But the title of the bill was an act requiring public disclosure, landowner notice of fracturing fluid information in oil and gas operations. And that included chemical disclosure prior to the hydraulic fracturing job, specific notice requirements that in part I think we are trying to address with our expanded notice to include homeowners and at this time any building that could be occupied that's within a quarter of a mile of a well. So That was just my closing one, and I think the only reason I included it is I'm tired of getting beaten up by industry about legislative intent. But it certainly is another thing that is on the horizon, and that is a legislative session. So.
And you might tell us what happened to this bill as long as you're
at it. It's included in the first page, but it was tabled in committee and missed the transmittal date.
In other words, it never really saw the light of day.
Right. It only had hearings in committee. And
okay. Board members, when it comes time to decide on this, there's no maybe button. I mean, it's either we move to initiate rulemaking as requested in the petition, or we move that the board deny the rulemaking petition. Would be nice if we could put some caveats in there to help a little bit one way or another, but it's the motion is going to have to be basically that simple. And it's going to have to be direct. Jim or Rob, either one, do you want to explain a little bit the conditions? Rob is...
Well, Madam Chair, I guess I would recommend that if the board members want to take this opportunity to discuss the public comment and the evidence, and then when we're ready to move to a motion, we can get into that process a little bit more thoroughly.
Sure. I thought it was open to discussion, but is there something that you want to bring forward and discuss? Is everything clear?
Steve.
I had really a question for Jim, but one of the things I think that's been maybe overlooked here and is brought up a number of times, the comparison to the Wyoming rule. The Wyoming rule, as you read it, is required to be disclosed to the supervisor, which would be you, correct, in Montana. And it says here that the supervisor will, at the company's request, maintain the proprietary nature of this, correct?
Correct.
Under Montana law, could you do that?
I question whether we could. Rob would probably be the best one to answer that, but I think that's something. And then in light of the federal trade secret changes, but maybe Rob could answer that one.
Rob?
As petitioners point out, there is the constitutional right to know that is a right that doesn't necessarily apply, at least not in the same way, not at a constitutional level in Wyoming or to the federal government. And so it introduces a series of questions and potential legal challenges in Montana that wouldn't necessarily apply to surrounding states.
Steve, are you thinking something like that would be a good thing?
No, I'm just thinking that the comparison to the Wyoming law really isn't appropriate because the disclosure is to the supervisor, not to the public. And the supervisor can maintain a trade secret, but he has that in the event of an emergency or a release or anything like that. He has that exact information. In Montana, it's my understanding that you, in possession of this information, could not, in fact, keep it private.
Our guidance, legal advice through the years that I've been here is if we have it in our office, it is public. And that change for the board operations, we used to be able to have a tight hole period on wells. And when the new constitution was adopted, we have banks of lockers down in the basement that we couldn't use anymore because if we have it, it is public information. So the guidance that I've been given historically is, yes, that would be the case, that it would be impossible for me without some change occurring to keep something from the public if they walked in and asked for it.
So, again, to just defer to my point, is that if we were to adopt something similar to the Wyoming rule here in Montana, there would be no trade secret protection.
Well, and that'd be up to our current attorney. I can only
that's where I'm leading here. But is that Montana law is different than Wyoming law.
Yeah. Montana law is different than Wyoming law, and whether or not there would be trade secret protections that would survive a challenge, a constitutional challenge to that statute, is unknown. It hasn't happened yet, but certainly it's liability, potential risk for the board that doesn't exist under Wyoming law. It's my understanding of Wyoming law.
Madam Chair, and I think the situation has not changed from 2011, and I think the comments in the trade secret discussion of that rule adoption are still applicable. There are many things that are unclear, and one of them is whether or not we can hold the trade secret or whether we really want to assume the risk of holding it.
I guess that would be my question to you, Jim. How would you feel about that?
If the federal law says I go to jail and you guys don't, I don't feel real good about it.
That's not what it would say exactly, but
I'm a person.
Well, thank you. I asked.
No, I think that just at this time we are uncertain what the implications of a requirement like Wyoming's.
Well, it would be a real responsibility, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a heavy one. Okay. Anybody else have some questions, comments? Are you ready to vote to consider the things we have to consider and get on with it?
Yeah.
Then, Rob, are you going to, or Jim?
Sure.
To talk
it.
About these responsibilities here.
All right. Madam Chair, we've got these very specific requirements in statute that the board needs to make sure we give due attention to and comply with about how we reach a decision, how the board reaches a decision on whether to initiate rulemaking or to deny the petition. And we've talked about them a few times, one of them be that it must be based on record evidence, and so that's the evidence that's been presented in writing and also here orally at the meeting, as well as part of the petition. And then there must be a written decision that includes the reasons for the decision. What I'd like to offer, Madam Chair, is a guidance document that contains some conceptual language for a board motion. I'm a little bit hesitant only because I don't want the board members to think that they are tied to this specific language, these specific reasons. And the conceptual language has both an example of a motion to initiate rulemaking and a motion to deny the rulemaking petition, because we need to have a reason for the decision as part of the board's decision. There are some examples of reasons the board may want to consider both in support and against the rulemaking petition, and I'd like to pass that out so that it's available to board members. The language can be ignored, can be used, it can be amended, supplemented, whatever, but it's a little bit of a technical process to make sure we do this the right way, and so with your permission, I'd like to hand that out to board members for consideration.
Sure, pass it out, and then let's give the board members a few minutes to look it over. So,
thank you.
I know if you read like I do, you're not going to just take it in by osmosis. You're going to have a minute or two to read and digest.
Thank you.
Yes, go ahead, Rob.
If there are any questions by board members about the process, as far as what we need to do, or if there are any questions by board members about maybe some of the reasons for the decision that the individual members are considering and would like to discuss, I can answer questions about the process, and then I can try to answer questions that you may have about legal issues, or Jim may be able to answer some questions about some of the substantive technical parts. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sure. I'll remind you that we need four positive votes one way or another because we need the majority of the board members, so that would be four. Peggy.
Once the motion is made, will we have a discussion period before a vote is taken?
Yes.
Or as we give our vote, does each person give a reason as to why they're voting the way they are voting?
Well, certainly we will have discussion. You know, I don't know about having a discussion about why you're voting. How? Go ahead, Rob.
Madam Chair, if I may, the requirement is that the board state the reasons for its decision, so I would recommend that the motion contain the reasons for the decision that the motion was made. If there's a discussion that needs to be had about those decisions, about those reasons, whether the board wants to change the reasons, add more reasons, take away reasons, whatever the board wants to do. But that process should continue until the board reaches a decision with reasons, specific reasons from the board. Other board, individual board members may have other reasons for voting one way or another, but the motion should contain the reasons for the board's decision.
So if somebody says, I move for whatever reason, and number 3, 4, and 5, but I only agree with number 1, do I have to say number 1? I'm just agreeing with number 1.
Your vote would be on the motion, even if you have other reasons outside of the motion.
Okay. Steve.
Well, in the interest of starting this rodeo, is it appropriate to make a motion?
It is appropriate to make a motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I make a motion to deny the rulemaking process. Four reasons I would state are that the pending Supreme Court decision on our current rule needs to run its course before we initiate any changes to said rule. Secondly, is the lack of trade secret protection under Montana law, as we currently understand it. Thirdly, it would be the uncertainty of the new federal trade secret law and the impact it might have on anything we do here today. And lastly, a decision this complicated and with this broad an implication, I believe, should be decided as part of the legislative process and not by the 7 of us governor's appointees. Those are my motions.
Motion.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Is there a second? Okay. Wayne seconds. Discussion. Ron.
Madam Chair, I would maybe flesh out one of Steve's reasons in that the Montana law is completely different from the Wyoming law that that is suggested that we follow. We have maybe not the board, but certainly our director has potential liability issues there, and maybe just say that what Montana law is different from Wyoming law, the one that we're asked to adopt.
You're asking that to be included in the reasoning.
Right.
Is that agreeable to you? Okay. Yes, Bob.
Madam Chair, if I may ask, just so that it's clear on the record what the reason is for the board's decision, Mr. Efta, if you're offering
maybe one
specific language.
Oh, okay.
We're being asked to adopt what's essentially a Wyoming rule, and our law is different from Wyoming in that we couldn't protect trade secrets, and it would expose some of our staff to liability issues.
Okay. Is there further discussion? Further discussion? I'll ask Jennifer if we'll do a roll call vote. Is everybody clear on the motion?
Just to be clear, a yes vote is in favor of the motion, which is to deny.
Yes.
Ms. Peggy Ames Nehru.
Thanks for starting with me. I support the motion.
So, yeah. Mr. Ron Efta.
I vote in favor of the motion.
Okay. Mr. Paul Gassmeyer.
I vote in favor of the motion.
Mr. Coy Welter.
I'm in favor of the motion.
Mr. Steve Durrett.
I'm in favor of the motion.
Mr. Wayne Smith.
I vote yes in favor of the motion.
And Chairman Nelson.
Yes. The motion carries, and that means that we will deny the rulemaking petition at this time for those reasons stated. Is there anything else to come before the board at this time? Seeing nothing, we will gather again at the end of October for our regular meeting, and for now we are adjourned. Thank you all for coming.
You were closer than I was.
No.